NSC counterterrorism chief Richard Clark tried to alert top administration officials, including Cheney, Rice, and Powell, to the Al-Qaeda threat from their very first days on the job. He warned that an attack was imminent. On January 25th, he requested that Rice call an urgent cabinet-level principals meeting to discuss the threat. He finally got his meeting on September 4th. Warning signs abounded in the summer of 2001. Intercepted Al-Qaeda messages stated that something spectacular was about to occur. FBI agents reported suspicious behavior by individuals who wanted to know how to fly passenger airplanes but were not interested in learning how to land. Tenet received an August briefing paper titled "Islamic Extremist Learns to Fly," about the arrest in Minnesota of Zacharias Moussaoui after officials at the flight school he was attending reported his strange behavior. Clark testified that CIA Director George Tenet was running around Washington with his hair on fire, trying to get Bush's attention. In late June, Tenet told Clark, "I feel it coming. This is going to be the big one." Intelligence agencies issued threat reports with headlines such as, "Bin Laden threats are real," "Bin Laden planning high-profile attacks," "Bin Laden planning multiple operations," "Bin Laden public profile may presage attack," and "Bin Laden's networks plans advancing." Alerts warned of a high probability of near-term spectacular attacks, resulting in numerous casualties and causing turmoil in the world. According to writer Thomas Powers, in the 9 months before September 11th, intelligence personnel had warned the administration as many as 40 times of the threat posed by Osama bin Laden, but that is not what the administration wanted to hear, and it did not hear it. The president's daily brief that Bush received at his Crawford, Texas ranch on August 6th was headlined, "Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S." It discussed the threat of Al-Qaeda operatives hijacking planes. Bush was as uninterested as ever, telling his CIA briefer, "All right, you've covered your ass now." Tenet later testified that the system was blinking red. Still, Bush had the temerity to tell a news conference in April 2004, "Had I any inkling whatsoever that the people were going to fly airplanes into buildings, we would have moved heaven and earth to save the country." Rice was equally culpable and equally disingenuous. During summer 2001, Tenet and CIA counterterrorism chief J. Cofer Black pushed her to adopt a plan to thwart bin Laden's pending attack. But Rice was preoccupied with ballistic missile defense. Frustrated, Black later remarked, "The only thing we didn't do was pull the trigger to the gun we were holding to her head." Rice later commented, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would try to use an airplane as a missile. A hijacked airplane as a missile." Bush and Rice's lack of interest was shared by others in the administration. Acting FBI Director Thomas Pickard told the 9/11 Commission that he had briefed Attorney General John Ashcroft twice that summer about the terrorist threat, but that, after the second briefing, Ashcroft told him he didn't want to hear about it anymore. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz also discounted the warnings. Rumsfeld went further, threatening, as late as September 9th, to get the president to veto Senate Armed Services Committee plans to transfer $600 million from the missile defense budget to counterterrorism. Nor at that time did many predict that Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and their cronies would use this criminal assault on the United States as an excuse to launch wars against two Islamic nations, wars that would cause far more damage to the United States than Osama bin Laden ever could, or to begin shredding the U.S. Constitution and the Geneva Convention. Chapter 13. The Bush-Cheney Debacle. The gates of hell are open in Iraq. George W. Bush was legendary for his misstatements and malapropisms. But sometimes, through the mangled syntax, a bit of truth would slip out. Such was the occasion in 2004 when he declared, "Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we." When Bush's party was unceremoniously booted out of office in 2008, he was rated by historians as among the very worst presidents in U.S. history, if not the absolute worst. His popularity and approval ratings set new lows for the modern era, but were actually higher than those of his even less popular vice president, Dick Cheney. Bush and Cheney left the country in shambles, its economy collapsing and its international reputation at an all-time low. After invading two countries, threatening many others, and undermining the rule of law at home and abroad, the once admired United States was now universally feared and widely condemned. People wondered whether the wrong-headed policies of the Bush-Cheney administration had resulted from ineptitude, hubris, and blind ambition, or if perhaps there was something more sinister about its plans for the United States and the world. Although the ever-cautious Barack Obama chose not to investigate the crimes of his predecessor, others would adhere more closely to the strictures of international law. In February 2011, George W. Bush was forced to cancel a speaking engagement in Switzerland for fear of massive protests against his torture policies. Activists were also planning to file a criminal complaint with Swiss prosecutors. Catherine Gallagher of the Center for Constitutional Rights explained, "Waterboarding is torture, and Bush has admitted without any sign of remorse that he approved its use. Torturers, even if they are former presidents of the United States, must be held to account and prosecuted. Impunity for Bush must end." Protest organizers urged demonstrators to bring a shoe in honor of the Iraqi journalist who was jailed for throwing his shoes at Bush in 2008. Referencing the 1998 London arrest of the late Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, Gavin Sullivan of the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights said, "What we have in Switzerland is a Pinochet opportunity." Amnesty International announced that similar steps would be taken if Bush traveled to any of the 147 nations that were party to the UN Convention Against Torture. The events of September 11, 2001, and the United States' reaction to them changed the course of history. On that day, Islamic extremists dealt the United States a crushing blow. With the president and his top aides asleep at the switch, Al-Qaeda hijackers flew planes into the premier symbols of U.S. imperial power, the World Trade Center and Pentagon. More than 2,750 people were killed in New York City, including some 500 foreign nationals from 91 countries. The nation watched in horror as flames engulfed the Twin Towers before their stunning collapse. Another 125 perished at the Pentagon. But the damage to the United States would pale in comparison to the damage the Bush administration wreaked in response to Al-Qaeda's heinous attack. Bush subsequently ignored demands to investigate how such a colossal intelligence and leadership failure could have occurred. When the pressure finally became too great, Bush turned to Henry Kissinger to produce an official whitewash. Even the New York Times wondered whether the choice of Kissinger, the consummate Washington insider, with his old friendships and business relationships, to chair the commission, was anything more than a clever maneuver by the White House to contain an investigation it long opposed. Kissinger received a visit from a group of New Jersey women who had been widowed in the attack. One asked him if he had any clients named Bin Laden. Kissinger spilled his coffee and nearly fell off his office couch. While his visitors rushed to clean up his mess, Kissinger tried to blame his clumsiness on his bad eye. The next morning, he resigned from the commission. Kissinger was replaced by former New Jersey Governor Thomas Kane, who, along with his co-chair, former Indiana Congressman Lee Hamilton, delivered the largely exculpatory report in 2004. In his book on the commission, New York Times reporter Philip Shannon placed the principal blame for the commission's gentle treatment of the responsible parties in the White House on the guiding hand of the commission executive director and Condoleezza Rice confidant, Philip Zelikow, whom some of the staff members considered to be a White House mole. Washington Post international correspondent Glenn Kessler described him as a one-person think tank for Rice, her intellectual soulmate. Rice's negligence in ignoring pre-9/11 warning signs that an attack was imminent was undeniable. For most Americans, 9/11 was a terrible tragedy. For Bush and Cheney, it was also an incredible opportunity. A chance to implement the agenda that their neoconservative allies had been cooking up for decades. The Project for a New American Century's recent report, Rebuilding America's Defenses, had stated that the process of transformation is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. Al-Qaeda had given PNACers their Pearl Harbor. Within minutes of the attack, the Bush team, minus the absent president, leapt into action. Vice President Cheney and his legal counsel David Addington took charge. Addington soon joined forces with Timothy Flanagan and John Yoo to argue that the president, as wartime commander-in-chief, could act virtually unfettered by legal constraints. Proceeding on that basis, Bush would sharply increase the powers of the executive branch and curtail civil liberties, declaring, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we are going to kick some ass." Bush and the PNACers in his administration knew precisely whose ass they wanted to kick. On September 12th, already looking past Al-Qaeda's Osama bin Laden and his Taliban collaborators in Afghanistan, Bush instructed counterterrorism chief Richard Clark, "See if Saddam did this. See if he's linked in any way." Clark, incredulous, responded, "But Mr. President, Al-Qaeda did this." Bush persisted. Detailing the encounter, Clark reported that when Bush walked away, Clark's assistant, Lisa Gordon Haggerty, stared after him with her mouth hanging open. "Wolfowitz got to him," she said. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz had a lot of help. His boss, Donald Rumsfeld, had already ordered the military to draw up strike plans for Iraq. "Go massive," he said. "Sweep it all up. Things related and not." Clark assumed that Rumsfeld was joking when he said Iraq had better targets than Afghanistan. He wasn't. On the morning of September 12th, CIA Director George Tenet ran into Richard Perle, who was leaving the West Wing of the White House. Perle declared, "Iraq has to pay a price for what happened yesterday. They bear responsibility." On September 13th, Wolfowitz announced that the response to the 9/11 attacks would extend well beyond Afghanistan to ending states who sponsor terrorism. That afternoon, when Rumsfeld spoke of expanding the mission to getting Iraq, Secretary of State Colin Powell insisted that they focus on Al-Qaeda. Clark thanked him and expressed his befuddlement over the obsession with Iraq. "Having been attacked by Al-Qaeda, for us now to go bombing Iraq in response would be like our invading Mexico after the Japanese attacked us at Pearl Harbor." Knowing whom he was dealing with, Powell shook his head. "It's not over yet," he said. Powell was right. The neocons would soon abandon the fig leaf of Iraqi involvement in 9/11. On September 20th, the PNAC wrote a letter to Bush stating that, "Even if evidence does not link Iraq directly to the attack, any strategy aiming at the eradication of terrorism and its sponsors must include a determined effort to remove Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq." The October 15th issue of William Kristol's Weekly Standard ran a cover story making The Case for American Empire, in which Max Boot blamed the September 11th attack on the fact that the United States had not sufficiently imposed its will on the world. Boot knew how to remedy that mistake. The debate about whether Saddam Hussein was implicated in the September 11th attacks misses the point. Who cares if Saddam was involved in this particular barbarity? Having been attacked by Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, the United States was preparing to retaliate against Iraq, whose leader, Saddam Hussein, was an avowed enemy of both Al-Qaeda and the anti-U.S. regime in Iran. Clark admitted, "At first, I was incredulous that we were talking about something other than getting Al-Qaeda. Then I realized with almost a sharp physical pain that Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz were going to try to take advantage of this national tragedy to promote their agenda about Iraq." Clark underestimated Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz. Their agenda went far beyond Iraq. From atop the rubble at the World Trade Center, Bush proclaimed, "Our responsibility to history is already clear, to answer these attacks and rid the world of evil." Cheney appeared on Meet the Press and said, "We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side. We've got to spend time in the shadows in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful. That's the world these folks operate in, and so it's going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal, basically, to achieve our objective." The administration moved to the dark side with alacrity. The following day, Bush authorized the CIA to establish detention facilities outside the United States, where torture and other harsh interrogation techniques would be employed. 4 days later, Bush announced before a joint session of Congress that the United States was embarking on a global war on terrorism, extending to any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism. Through its policy of extraordinary rendition, the CIA began seizing suspects without any legal proceedings being brought against them, and flying them to secret black sites around the world. The CIA requested and received presidential authorization to hunt down, capture, and kill members of Al-Qaeda and other terrorists anywhere in the world. In October, a senior official told the Washington Post's Bob Woodward that the president had directed the CIA to undertake its most sweeping and lethal covert action since the founding of the agency in 1947. "The gloves are off," the official said. "The president has given the agency the green light to do whatever is necessary." Lethal operations that were unthinkable pre-September 11th are now underway. Cheney noted another important change. "It is different than the Gulf War was," he told Woodward, "in the sense that it may never end, at least not in our lifetime." In fact, many things that were unthinkable before September 11th were happening now. First and foremost, the White House began usurping unprecedented powers, powers that threatened the U.S. constitutional order. To make that possible, Bush exploited the post-9/11 climate of fear and uncertainty. In the days after 9/11, the government arrested and detained 1,200 men in the United States, most of whom were either Muslims or of Middle Eastern or South Asian extraction. Another 8,000 were sought for interrogation. Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold demanded a halt to such profiling. "This is a dark hour for civil liberties in America," he warned. "What I'm hearing from Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, South Asians and others, suggests a climate of fear toward our government that is unprecedented." Bush rushed the USA Patriot Act through Congress. The Senate version was sent straight to the floor without discussion, debate, or hearings. In this crisis atmosphere, only Feingold had the courage to vote against it, insisting, "It is crucial that civil liberties in this country be preserved. Otherwise, I'm afraid the terror will win this battle without firing a shot. It passed in the House by a vote of 337-79, and Bush signed it into law on October 26, 2001. The Patriot Act expanded government surveillance and investigative powers. In 2002, Bush empowered the National Security Agency to conduct warrantless wiretaps in violation of the legal reviews required by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, courts, and to monitor U.S. citizens' email. To convince the American people to accept such blatant infringement on their privacy and civil liberties, the administration barraged the public with constant alerts, heightened security, and a five-tier system of color-coded warnings that fluctuated based on each day's danger of terrorist attack. The system was so obviously being manipulated by Rumsfeld and Attorney General John Ashcroft that Bush's Secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, felt compelled to resign after one particularly egregious episode. The administration also began identifying points of vulnerability, listing 160 sites as potential terrorist targets. By the end of 2003, the number climbed to 1,849. 1 year later, it stood at 28,360. It jumped to an astounding 78,000 in 2005 and 300,000 in 2007. Even the nation's heartland wasn't immune. Amazingly, Indiana led all states with the most potential targets, 8,591, almost three times as many as California. The national database included petting zoos, donut shops, popcorn stands, ice cream parlors, and the Mule Day Parade in Columbia, Tennessee. Bush made it clear that this was a new kind of war, a war fought not against a nation or even an ideology, but against a tactic, terrorism. As retired ambassador Ronald Spears pointed out, framing it that way was deliberate and pernicious. Choosing the war metaphor, he wrote in 2004, is neither accurate nor innocuous, implying as it does that there is an end point of either victory or defeat. A war on terrorism is a war without an end in sight, without an exit strategy, with enemies specified not by their aims, but by their tactics. The president has found this war useful as an all-purpose justification for almost anything he wants or doesn't want to do. It brings to mind Big Brother's vague and never-ending war in Orwell's 1984. It was also a new kind of war in that it would require no sacrifice from the overwhelming majority of Americans. The fighting would fall on the members of a volunteer army drawn largely from the lower ranks of society. The cost would be borne by future generations. Whereas, at the start of World War II, Franklin Roosevelt had warned, "War costs money. That means taxes and bonds and taxes. It means cutting luxuries and other non-essentials." Bush saw things differently. He cut taxes on the wealthy and told Americans to visit America's great destination spots and enjoy life the way we want it to be enjoyed. New York Times columnist Frank Rich captured the unreality. "No one is demanding that the rest of us pay for serious airline or bioterror security, or that we cut down on gas guzzling to reduce our dependency on the oil of Saudi Arabia, whose other big export is terrorists. Instead, we are told to go shopping, take in a show, go to Disneyland." Bush asked the American people to make a hard choice, whether to visit Disney World or Disneyland. He gave the Afghan Taliban a different choice, either turn over the Al-Qaeda leaders or be bombed back to the Stone Age, which much of Afghanistan had never left. "Bombing Afghanistan back to the Stone Age," wrote Tamim Ansari, an Afghan living in the United States for 35 years and a bitter foe of bin Laden and the Taliban, "that's been done. The Soviets took care of it already. Make the Afghans suffer? They're already suffering. Level their houses? Done. Turn their schools into piles of rubble? Done. Eradicate their hospitals? Done. Destroy their infrastructure? Cut them off from medicine and health care? Too late. Someone already did all that. New bombs would only stir the rubble of earlier bombs. Would they at least get the Taliban? Not likely. Other critics of the rush to war pointed out that no Afghans were among the 19 hijackers. 15 were Saudis, 1 Lebanese, 1 Egyptian, and 2 were from the United Arab Emirates. They had lived in Hamburg and trained and took flight lessons primarily in the United States. On October 7, 2001, less than a month after the terrorist attacks, the United States and its allies launched Operation Enduring Freedom. The Taliban leaders quickly got the message and scrambled to negotiate. On October 15th, Taliban former minister Wakil Ahmed Mutawakil, whom the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad considered to be very close to Taliban leader Mullah Muhammad Omar, offered to turn bin Laden over to the Organization of the Islamic Conference, OIC, for trial. Evidence suggests that Omar had been trying to rein in bin Laden for some time, and that relations between the Afghans and Al-Qaeda had been frayed. U.S. representatives had actually had more than 20 meetings with Taliban officials during the previous 3 years to discuss their turning bin Laden over for trial. U.S. officials concluded that the Taliban were stalling. Milton Bearden, the former CIA station chief, who oversaw the 1980s covert war in Afghanistan from his Pakistani base, disagreed, blaming U.S. obtuseness and inflexibility. "We never heard what they were trying to say," he told the Washington Post. "We had no common language. Ours was, give up bin Laden. They were saying, do something to help us give him up." U.S. State Department and embassy officials met with Taliban security chief Hamid Razoli, as late as August 2001. "I have no doubts they wanted to get rid of him," Bearden said in October 2001. But the United States never offered the face-saving measures the Taliban needed. Rumsfeld's high-tech warfare succeeded in sharply limiting U.S. casualties, but the lack of U.S. boots on the ground allowed bin Laden, Omar, and many of their supporters to slip away when the United States had them trapped at Tora Bora in December 2001. Afghan civilians didn't fare as well, suffering approximately 4,000 deaths, according to University of New Hampshire professor Mark Herold, more than the number killed at the World Trade Center and Pentagon combined. Perhaps 5 times that number would die from disease and starvation in the months to follow. Although Bush quickly lost interest in Afghanistan and turned his attention to Iraq, the war dragged on for the remainder of his presidency. Hamid Karzai ruled through brutal warlords and corrupt functionaries who turned Afghanistan into the world's biggest supplier of opium. By 2004, Afghanistan was supplying 87% of the world total. In 2009, the country ranked second only to Somalia on the Global Corruption Index. Fed up with corruption and exhausted by war, many Afghans welcomed back the Taliban, despite their earlier disgust with repressive Taliban policies. Though the 9/11 plotters slipped easily through their fingers, the CIA and military did round up thousands of others in Afghanistan and beyond. Their treatment would signal just how dark Bush and Cheney were willing to go in the name of the United States, a country that had always considered its humane treatment of prisoners a sign of its moral superiority. Bush branded the detainees unlawful enemy combatants, not prisoners of war whose rights had to be respected, and threw them into the U.S. Naval Station at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or into the CIA's black site prisons, where they could be held indefinitely. The least fortunate were delivered for even worse abuse by allied governments known for their cruelty, like Hosni Mubarak's Egypt and Bashar al-Assad's Syria. Bush waived the battlefield hearings required by the Geneva Convention to determine whether captives were civilians or combatants. As a result, many prisoners who had no connection to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban were rounded up by unscrupulous Iraqis and Afghans seeking U.S. cash bounties. Innocent prisoners had no means of appeal. On the advice of White House legal counsel Alberto Gonzalez, Bush declared that the Geneva Conventions on the Treatment of Prisoners of War, which the United States ratified in 1955, did not apply to suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda members. Among those outraged by Bush's abrogation of the Geneva Conventions was Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Richard Myers. The CIA was instructed to employ 10 enhanced interrogation methods, the product of 5 decades of research into psychological torture. The techniques were spelled out in the CIA's 1963 KUBARC, Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual, and honed by U.S. allies in Asia and Latin America in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. Such psychological torture had been abandoned at the end of the Cold War and repudiated in 1994 when the United States signed the UN Convention Against Torture. It was back in force after 9/11 and often went beyond the strictly psychological. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. told journalist Jane Mayer that he considered the new torture policy, as Mayer put it, the most dramatic, sustained, and radical challenge to the rule of law in American history. The CIA outlined the procedures in detail. Upon arrest, the suspect would be deprived of sight and sound, with blindfold and earmuffs. If the detainee proved uncooperative, he would be stripped naked, flooded with constant bright light and high-volume noise up to 79 decibels, and kept awake for up to 180 hours. Once the prisoner was convinced that he had no control, serious interrogation would begin. After guards shackled the prisoner's arms and legs, placed a collar around his neck, and removed the hood covering his head, interrogators would slap him across the face, sometimes repeatedly, and, using the collar as a handle, slam his head into the wall up to 30 times. Subsequent methods included dousing the prisoner with water, denying him the use of toilet facilities, forcing him to wear dirty diapers, chaining him to ceilings, and requiring him to stand or kneel in painful positions for prolonged periods of time. The International Committee of the Red Cross reported that prisoners at Guantanamo were told that they were being taken to the verge of death and back. Waterboarding was employed in special cases, and sometimes repeatedly, despite the fact that the United States had prosecuted Japanese military interrogators for use of waterboarding against U.S. prisoners during World War II. The process was described by Malcolm Nance, an interrogation expert who had been an instructor with the U.S. military's Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, SEER, program, to train U.S. soldiers to withstand interrogation. Unless you have been strapped down to the board, have endured the agonizing feeling of the water overpowering your gag reflex, and then feel your throat open and allow pint after pint of water to involuntarily fill your lungs, you will not know the meaning of the word. Waterboarding is a controlled drowning that, in the American model, occurs under the watch of a doctor, a psychologist, an interrogator, and a trained strap-in, strap-out team. It does not simulate drowning, as the lungs are actually filling with water. There is no way to simulate that. The victim is drowning. How much the victim is to drown depends on the desired result, in the form of answers to questions shouted into the victim's face, and the obstinacy of the subject. Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded in Bangkok at least 83 times over a 4 or 5 day period in August 2002, even though interrogators were convinced he was telling the truth. Still, CIA officials at the Counterterrorism Center at Langley demanded that the procedure be continued for a month, backing down only when the interrogators threatened to quit. Upon Zubaydah's capture, Bush identified him as Al-Qaeda's chief of operations. In reality, though, Zubaydah turned out to be a minor operative, not even an official member of Al-Qaeda, who may very well have been mentally ill. The Washington Post reported in 2009, "The methods succeeded in breaking him, and the stories he told of Al-Qaeda terrorism plots sent CIA officers around the globe chasing leads. In the end, though, not a single significant plot was foiled as a result of Abu Zubaydah's tortured confessions, according to former senior government officials who closely followed the interrogations. And, the Post acknowledged, whatever information investigators extracted that might have had any marginal utility had come out before the waterboarding began. The waterboarding did yield an abundance of information, according to the Post. Abu Zubaydah began unspooling the details of various Al-Qaeda plots, including plans to unleash weapons of mass destruction. Abu Zubaydah's revelations triggered a series of alerts and sent hundreds of CIA and FBI investigators scurrying in pursuit of phantoms. One former intelligence official admitted, "We spent millions of dollars chasing false alarms." Purported 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded 183 times, as if he were going to disclose something on the 183rd time that he hadn't divulged in the previous 182. Psychologists help refine techniques, exploiting prisoners' phobias. Interrogators also exploited Arabs' cultural sensitivities by subjecting prisoners to public nudity and snarling dogs. In February 2004, Major General Antonio Taguba reported that his investigation had turned up numerous instances of sadistic, blatant, and wanton criminal abuses at Abu Ghraib Detention Center, including rape of both male and female prisoners. Only 4 months earlier, Bush had announced, a bit prematurely perhaps, that Iraq is free of rape rooms and torture chambers. After the Abu Ghraib expose created an international uproar in 2004, the Justice Department withdrew the legal memo authorizing torture. The damage done to the United States' international reputation was incalculable. Arthur Schlesinger Jr. confided, "No position taken has done more damage to the American reputation in the world, ever, than Bush's torture policy." However, the CIA subsequently captured another Al-Qaeda suspect and again sought permission to employ brutal interrogation methods. Rice responded, "This is your baby. Go do it." Journalist Patrick Coburn interviewed the senior U.S. interrogator in Iraq who had elicited the information that led to the capture of Iraqi Al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. He told Coburn that torture not only produces no useful information, but its use in Iraq has proved so counterproductive that it may have led to the death of as many U.S. soldiers as civilians killed in 9/11. Although officials tried to pin the blame on a few bad apples, sadistic rogue interrogators who took matters into their own hands, torture was approved by the top administration officials. Members of the National Security Council's Principals Committee, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, Powell, Tenet, and Ashcroft, met repeatedly to specify which methods would be used on which prisoners. Ashcroft interrupted one NSC discussion and asked, "Why are we talking about this in the White House? History will not judge this kindly." General Barry McCaffrey agreed, "We tortured people unmercifully. We probably murdered dozens of them during the course of that, both the armed forces and the CIA." For years, the 770-plus prisoners at Guantanamo and thousands more in Iraq and Afghanistan were denied legal counsel and the right to call witnesses to defend themselves. As of late 2008, charges had been brought against only 23. Over 500 had been released without being charged, often after years of harsh and humiliating treatment. One FBI counterterrorism expert testified that, of the Guantanamo detainees, 50 at most were worth holding. Major General Taguba said, "There is no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account." The legal groundwork, which dated back to the 1990s, was provided by Justice Department lawyers. In one particularly outrageous memo, John Yoo and Assistant Attorney General Jay Bibee defined torture as pain equivalent in intensity to organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. And then only if inflicting the pain was the deliberate purpose of the interrogation. In 2004, when the Supreme Court ruled that detainees had the right to challenge the legality of their detention in the federal courts, Bush established the Combat Status Review Tribunal and an annual review board to sidestep the ruling. Finally, in June 2008, the Supreme Court ruled that detainees had a right to federal court review of the basis of their detention. Americans' rights were often trampled on as well. In an effort to preempt protests, federal and local authorities conducted sweeping arrests of legal protesters on numerous occasions, including at the Republican conventions in both 2004 and 2008. Bush did his best to avoid the protests that did occur. On the rare occasions when he ventured out in public, the Secret Service would quarantine critics in protest zones so far away that neither Bush nor the media could see them. Those holding protest signs outside the designated areas were subject to arrest. London's Evening Standard reported that when Bush visited London in 2003, the White House demanded that the British impose a virtual 3-day shutdown of central London in a bid to foil disruption of the visit by anti-war protesters. Taking his cue from Cheney, Bush cloaked White House deliberations in a veil of secrecy so impenetrable that it was unprecedented in U.S. history. Access to documents under the Freedom of Information Act was sharply curtailed, and documents once publicly available were reclassified and disappeared. The government repeatedly invoked national security and state secrets to thwart those attempting to bring lawsuits. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, chief of staff to Colin Powell, said he had never seen such secrecy and described it as a cobble between Cheney and Rumsfeld to bypass normal channels. Conservatives, too, objected. "We see an unprecedented secrecy in this White House that we find very troubling," said Judicial Watch Director Larry Klayman in 2002. "True conservatives don't act this way." But repressive measures in the United States paled in comparison to the measures Bush inflicted on the rest of the world. And the worst was still to come, as U.S. policymakers geared up for the invasion of Iraq, which had actually been on the drawing board long before 9/11. Wolfowitz's obsession with Iraq dated at least as far back as 1979, when he directed a Pentagon assessment of the Persian Gulf region that highlighted Iraq's threat to its neighbors, particularly Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and proposed a buildup of U.S. forces in the region to counter this threat. The report began, "We and our major industrialized allies have a vital and growing stake in the Persian Gulf region because of our need for Persian Gulf oil and because events in the Persian Gulf affect the Arab-Israeli conflict." Based on that report, the United States had begun positioning cargo ships laden with military equipment in the region. Wolfowitz nurtured that obsession in the intervening years. He and his allies had made dealing with Iraq a top priority of the PNAC. He fixated relentlessly on Iraq as Deputy Secretary of Defense. A senior administration official observed, "If you look around the world at other issues, he's non-existent. He's not a major player on any other issue. In fact," the official commented, "he doesn't even know the Defense Department position on other issues." Iraq rose to the top of administration concerns almost from the moment Bush took office. He opened his first National Security Council meeting on January 30th, 2001, by asking, "So, Condi, what are we going to talk about today? What's on the agenda?" "How Iraq is destabilizing the region, Mr. President," Rice replied. Administration neocons were on board from the start. When the NSC principals met again 2 days later, Rumsfeld interrupted Powell's discussion of targeted sanctions against Iran. Sanctions are fine, he blurted out, but what we really want to think about is going after Saddam. He later added, imagine what the region would look like without Saddam, and with a regime that's aligned with U.S. interests. It would change everything in the region and beyond it. It would demonstrate what U.S. policy is all about. Looking back, Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill recognized that the die had been cast from the very beginning. From the start, we were building the case against Hussein and looking at how we could take him out and change Iraq into a new country. And if we did that, it would solve everything. It was all about finding a way to do it. That was the tone of it. The president saying, fine, go find me a way to do this. O'Neill told Ron Suskind that as early as March 2001, administration officials were discussing concrete plans for invading and occupying Iraq. Cheney's Energy Task Force played an important part. Other invasion backers included Wolfowitz proteges, I. Lewis Scooter Libby, who was Cheney's national security advisor, Stephen Hadley, who was Rice's deputy, and Richard Pearl, now head of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board. On September 19th and 20th, Defense Policy Board members decided to put Iraq in the crosshairs as soon as they disposed of Afghanistan. The New York Times reported that the insiders promoting the invasion were called the Wolfowitz Cabal. Members of the cabal searched high and low for an Iraqi connection to 9/11. Rumsfeld asked the CIA to come up with evidence linking Iraq to 9/11 on at least 10 separate occasions. Prisoners were tortured in the hope that they would divulge such information. But none existed. Rumsfeld and Cheney reviled the CIA analysts who pointed out this inconvenient fact. Lacking evidence, they manufactured their own. Cheney and Libby pointed repeatedly to a meeting in Prague between the hijacker Mohammed Atta and an Iraqi intelligence official. Even though Tenet had proved that Atta was in the United States at the time of the alleged meeting, living in Virginia in the shadow of CIA headquarters, Wolfowitz turned to Lori Milroy, whose thoroughly discredited writings had tied Iraq to practically every terrorist episode in recent memory, including the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. Milroy complained that the Clinton administration had dismissed her as a nutcase. CNN analyst Peter Bergen called her a crackpot, a view shared by the intelligence community. He mocked her unified field theory of terrorism. But Wolfowitz and Pearl took her seriously, as did New York Times reporter Judith Miller, with whom she co-authored a 1990 book about Saddam Hussein. Wolfowitz sent former CIA director James Woolsey on a wild goose chase overseas to try to corroborate her cockamamie theories. Though most of the administration neocons stopped short of Milroy's assertion that Al-Qaeda is a front for Iraqi intelligence, Bush and Cheney repeatedly alluded to Iraqi involvement in the 9/11 attacks. In September 2003, Cheney told Meet the Press's Tim Russert that Iraq was the heart of the base, if you will, the geographic base of the terrorists who have had us under assault now for many years, but most especially on 9/11. The CIA, meanwhile, was conjuring up its own perverse and outlandish ways to discredit both Saddam and bin Laden. The CIA's Iraq Operations Group considered fabricating a video showing Saddam having sex with a teenage boy and then flooding Iraq with the videos. It would look like it was taken by a hidden camera, said a former official, very grainy, like it was a secret videotaping of a sex session. The CIA did actually produce a video simulating bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda buddies around a campfire imbibing liquor and sharing tales of sexual encounters with boys. Such undertakings were only slightly less bizarre than the actual intelligence collected during the build-up to the war. One of the administration's favorite intelligence sources was Ahmed Chalabi, who headed the Iraqi National Congress, INC. The INC, which received millions of dollars from the Bush administration, relayed fanciful reports of ongoing WMD programs from Iraqi defectors, many of whom were clearly out to instigate a U.S. attack. Later, with the Americans occupying Baghdad, Chalabi boasted, "We are heroes in error. As far as we're concerned, we've been entirely successful." One former top Defense Intelligence Agency official, Colonel Patrick Lang, saw Defense Department fingerprints all over this. "The Pentagon has banded together to dominate the government's foreign policy, and they've pulled it off," he complained bitterly. "They're running Chalabi. The DIA has been intimidated and beaten to a pulp, and there's no guts at all in the CIA." Using this kind of notoriously false information, the administration challenged the findings of CIA analysts and UN weapons inspectors, and tirelessly made its case for invading Iraq. "We know they have weapons of mass destruction," Rumsfeld insisted. "There isn't any debate about it." In early October 2002, Bush, echoing a similar warning from Rice the month before, announced, "We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud." But no one could outdo Cheney when it came to outright fabrications and dire prognostications. "The Iraqi regime has been very busy enhancing its capabilities in the field of chemical and biological agents, and they continue to pursue the nuclear program. Armed with an arsenal of these weapons of terror and a seat at the top 10% of the world's oil reserves, Saddam Hussein could then be expected to seek domination of the entire Middle East, take control of a great portion of the world's energy supplies, directly threaten America's friends throughout the region, and subject the United States or any other nation to nuclear blackmail. Simply stated, there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us." Based upon this fictitious threat assessment, which the intelligence community echoed in its national intelligence estimate of October 2002, Bush readied for war while maintaining the facade of seeking a peaceful resolution. In March 2002, he popped unexpectedly into a meeting between Rice and a bipartisan group of senators and exclaimed, "Fuck Saddam, we're taking him out." In May, he told Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, "I'm going to kick his sorry motherfucking ass all over the Mideast." But some experts knew that Bush's claims about Iraqi WMD were grossly exaggerated, if not completely false. Former Chief UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter told CNN in 2002, "No one has substantiated the allegations that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction, or is attempting to acquire weapons of mass destruction." CNN's Fanula Sweeney pointed out, "It is hard to account if you cannot get into the country." Ritter's response to that and subsequent questions shed important light on the administration's use of WMD as a casus belli. "That's right. Then why did the United States pick up the phone in December 1998 and order the inspectors out? Let's remember, Saddam Hussein didn't kick the inspectors out. The U.S. ordered the inspectors out 48 hours before they initiated Operation Desert Fox, military action that didn't have the support of the U.N. Security Council, and which used information gathered by the inspectors to target Iraq. As of December 1998, we had accounted for 90% to 95% of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction capability, we being the weapons inspectors. We destroyed all the factories, all the means of production, and we couldn't account for some of the weaponry. But chemical weapons have a shelf life of 5 years. Biological weapons have a shelf life of 3 years. To have weapons today, they would have had to rebuild the factories and start the process of producing these weapons since December 1998. How much access did you get to the weapons inspection sites?" Sweeney asked. 100%, Ritter assured her. Though Ritter was persona non grata within the administration and could be easily dismissed, there was no excuse for ignoring the cautionary words of General Tommy Franks, the head of U.S. Central Command, whom Rumsfeld tasked with drawing up war plans. At a September 2002 meeting of the NSC, Frank stated bluntly, Mr. President, we've been looking for Scud missiles and other weapons of mass destruction for 10 years, and haven't found any yet. Leading establishment figures, including several linked to the president's father, tried to convince Bush that an invasion would be pure folly. The dissenters included General Brent Scowcroft, who had been George H.W. Bush's national security advisor, James Baker, Lawrence Eagleburger, and George Kennan. Military opposition also ran deep. Marine Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold, Director of Operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, recalled, "I can't tell you how many senior officers said to me, 'What the hell are we doing?' They asked, 'Why Iraq? Why now?'" British Prime Minister Tony Blair stepped forward to lend a hand. In September 2002, Blair, who would be widely mocked as Bush's poodle, released a dossier about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction that was so riddled with falsehoods it would later prove scandalous. Blair insisted, however, on getting a UN resolution to provide him with political cover in Britain, where anti-war sentiment remained strong. The UN Security Council voted to send inspectors into Iraq again. Saddam accepted unconditionally. Inspections began in November. Over the next 3.5 months, UN inspectors visited 500 sites, some repeatedly. The list included those identified by the CIA as the most likely locations for concealing WMD. Nothing turned up. UN Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix wondered, if this was the best, what was the rest? Could there be 100% certainty about the existence of weapons of mass destruction, but 0% knowledge about their location? Blix later compared Bush administration officials to medieval witch hunters who were so convinced there were witches, when they looked for them, they certainly found them. In the midst of this latest round of inspections, Iraq submitted its 11,800-page weapons dossier to the United Nations. "Iraq has no weapons of mass destruction," declared Lieutenant General Hossam Mohammed Amin. But Bush, having already stipulated that any weapons declaration that did not admit to having WMD would be fraudulent, dismissed it scornfully. "The declaration is nothing. It's empty. It's a joke," he told visiting Spanish Prime Minister José María Aznar. "At some point, we will conclude that enough is enough and take him out." Iraq's UN Ambassador Mohammed Al-Douri challenged the United States to provide evidence of its allegations. Not only did the United States have no reliable evidence, it edited out more than 8,000 pages from Iraq's report before passing it on to the 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council, in part to hide the role of U.S. government and 24 major U.S. corporations in supporting Iraq's weapons programs. After rigorous inspections, Blix refused to charge Iraq with being in violation of UN Resolution 1441, requiring Iraq to disarm. Newsweek reported on March 3, 2003, that Saddam's son-in-law, Hussein Kamel, who had run Iraq's WMD programs for 10 years before defecting in 1995, told the CIA, British intelligence, and UN inspectors that Iraq had destroyed all its chemical and biological weapons after the Gulf War. Rolf Ekeus, who headed the UN inspections team from 1991 to 1997, said that Kamel's information was almost embarrassing, it was so extensive. Between 1991 and 1998, UN inspectors supervised the destruction of 817 of Iraq's 819 prescribed medium-range missiles, 9 trailers, 14 launchers, and 56 fixed missile launch sites. Iraq also destroyed 73 of 75 chemical or biological warheads, 163 warheads for conventional explosives, 88,000 filled and unfilled chemical munitions, 4,000 tons of precursor chemicals, more than 600 tons of weaponized and bulk chemical weapons agents, and 980 pieces of equipment essential for production of such weapons. The Iraqis destroyed Al-Hakam, the main facility producing and developing biological weapons, plus 60 pieces of equipment taken from three other facilities, and 22 tons of growth media for biological weapons. If Middle Eastern and South Asian countries having WMD were by itself sufficient reason to justify a U.S. invasion, there were several other potential targets in the area. In the 2002 report titled Weapons of Mass Destruction in the Middle East, Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies listed Egypt, chemical, India, chemical, biological, nuclear, Iran, chemical, biological, Israel, chemical, biological, nuclear, Libya, chemical, Pakistan, chemical, biological, nuclear, and Syria, chemical, biological. In fact, Iraq posed no threat. It had destroyed so many weapons between 1991 and 1998 that it had become one of the weaker states in the region. Its military expenditures were just a fraction of that of some of its neighbors. In 2002, Iraq spent approximately $1.4 billion on its military. The United States spent more than 300 times that amount. Nevertheless, the scare tactics worked. To make sure they would, the administration deliberately timed the congressional vote to occur before the 2002 midterm elections and threatened to brand all who opposed the rush to war as unpatriotic and cowardly at a time of grave national crisis. Many caved in to the pressure, including Hillary Clinton and John Kerry. On October 2, 2002, the Senate voted 77-23 to authorize the use of force. The House did likewise, 296-133. The resolution directly connected Iraq to al-Qaeda and alleged that Iraq posed a threat to the United States. Only one Republican, Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, voted against the resolution in the Senate. He later condemned the spinelessness of top Democrats who had succumbed to Bush's blackmail. They were afraid that Republicans would label them soft in the post-September 11th world, and when they acted in political self-interest, they helped the president send thousands of Americans and uncounted innocent Iraqis to their doom. Chafee watched as cowering Democrats repeatedly went down to the meetings at the White House and the Pentagon and came back to the chamber ready to salute. With wrinkled brows, they gravely intoned that Saddam Hussein must be stopped. Stopped from what? They had no conviction or evidence of their own. They were just parroting the administration's nonsense. Among the groups lobbying Congress to support the war was the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, an influential organization that was considerably to the right of mainstream American Jewish opinion, and generally in lockstep with the neocons on Middle East policy. In January 2003, AIPAC executive director Howard Kaur told the New York Sun that quietly lobbying Congress to approve the use of force in Iraq had been one of AIPAC's successes over the past year. Much has rightly been made of the administration's neocons' fierce defense of what they perceived as Israeli interests, which in their minds included toppling Saddam Hussein. Again, Wolfowitz led the way. The Jerusalem Post reported that Bush's appointment of Wolfowitz as Deputy Secretary of Defense had the Jewish and pro-Israel communities jumping with joy. In 2002, the Forward described him as the most hawkishly pro-Israel voice in the administration. If his was the most hawkishly pro-Israel voice, others, including Under Secretary of Defense Douglas Feith's, Pearls, Libby's, and Bolton's, were close behind. Having pushed the resolution through Congress, the administration continued peddling fraudulent and thoroughly discredited claims. Bush unveiled one of the most infamous in the January 2003 State of the Union Address, declaring, "The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa." An allegation that Joseph Wilson, former deputy chief of mission to Iraq and former ambassador to three African countries, had already shown to be false. When Wilson later exposed the administration's mendacity, top officials, including Libby, retaliated by illegally outing Wilson's wife as a covert CIA operative, destroying her career and putting many people in jeopardy. Relying on evidence provided by Fife, which had been repeatedly refuted point by point by CIA and DIA analysts, Cheney and Libby made frequent visits to Langley, pressing CIA analysts to reconsider their assertion that Iraq had no ties to al-Qaeda. Tension between administration hawks and intelligence analysts escalated. As National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East, Paul Pillar was in charge of the intelligence community's assessments on Iraq. He described the poisonous atmosphere in which administration supporters were accusing him and other intelligence officers of trying to sabotage the president's policies. On one occasion, when Hadley demanded that the deputy director for intelligence revise the link paper, Tenet phoned Hadley in a fit of pique and shouted, "We are not rewriting this fucking report one more time. It is fucking over, do you hear me? And don't you ever fucking treat my people this way again. Ever." But the most ignominious moment came on February 5th, 2003, when Secretary of State Colin Powell, the most respected and trusted member of the administration, went